Having to get up and leave your home for work or school is a challenge most of us face every day. But what if you don't have a home? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Being homeless in Iowa, our topic today. We'll talk with an Iowan who used to be homeless and find out about services to help the homeless improve their situations. Also, Mayor Matt Hayek of Iowa City comments on proposed new restrictions on panhandling and behavior in the downtown area. Have you ever been without a home for an extended period? What put you on the streets? And how did you manage to get a roof over your head again? Our discussion starts after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Being homeless in Iowa, that's our topic today. And in just a moment, we'll talk with an Iowan who used to be homeless and find out about services to help the homeless improve their situations. But first, joining me, Mayor Matt Hayek of Iowa City. He's going to tell us a little bit about some new restrictions on panhandling and behavior in the downtown area there. Mayor Hayek, welcome to our program.
Good morning, Ben. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Full disclosure, your law practice, Hayek Brown, Moreland & Smith, is an underwriter for Iowa Public Radio. Let's get right to it, because in 2010, the Iowa City City Council passed an ordinance that went into effect that year restricting the asking of money, panhandling. Now there are new restrictions. What are they?
Well, Ben, several years ago, we adopted an ordinance restricting solicitation and panhandling in certain areas of town and for certain activities. But it's important to understand what is and what is not permissible. There are two types of soliciting. One is passive and one is aggressive. You can't cause physical contact or touch someone, or if you follow after a person after that person refuses to donate money. So that would be aggressive soliciting. And passive soliciting is anything other than aggressive soliciting. And by the way, soliciting is more than simply a person sitting there with a sign that says, I'm homeless. It could be anyone raising money for a cause, United Way or any other charity. We don't distinguish between who is doing the soliciting. It's the actual type and way in which the soliciting is done that we look at. So you have aggressive soliciting. Passive soliciting is anything else. That would be, you know, being in one place with a sign seeking money, whether you're homeless or raising money for a charity. And we allow passive soliciting outside of the downtown area unless it's causing a safety concern. You're impeding vehicular or pedestrian traffic. In the downtown area, we permit passive soliciting in certain areas, but not in other areas. We don't allow it near crosswalks or next to ATMs or in sidewalk cafes, areas where people are essentially a captive audience. And so we've been very careful to balance the rights of individuals to solicit passively with the rights of people to be in places and not be cornered.
Mm-hmm. Well, why now, Mayor? Iowa City has had a long history of people in the downtown area of all sorts, and some of them soliciting money. What's changed?
Well, we've seen over the last year or two an uptick in behaviors in our pedestrian mall that are of concern to the community. And it's not just soliciting. It's a range of behaviors that are troubling to downtown patrons, families, business owners, and the like. And that forced us to take a look at what's going on down there and the level of enforcement and legislation that we apply to the pedestrian mall. The pedestrian mall, for those who don't know, is the central part of downtown Iowa City. It's the quintessential public space, and it's packed with people, which is a good thing because we have so many people in downtown Iowa City. It's a vibrant downtown, and we have workers and students and restaurant goers and library users and visitors. And we also have people who are just hanging out and people who are down on their luck. And balancing that multitude of uses is always a challenge. So what we're looking at in 2013 is an ordinance that that sets a level of behavior expectation on the part of the community as to what is and what is not permitted in our very public space.
Mm-hmm. What specific instances have been cited in the discussions that you've had there, also with city council members? I see a local report where council member and downtown business owner Connie Champion cited not only aggressive panhandling, but sexual activity.
Well, yes. And look, you know, the vast, vast majority of people who use our Ped Mall don't engage in anything other than perfectly good behavior, and it's a great place. And I bring my family down to it regularly. I use it regularly, but there are examples, and we've heard them from members of the council, from staff, from people in the community, from families, from patrons downtown, of inappropriate behavior, lewd behavior, things of that nature. We've also had problems with people occupying park benches, leaving things for extended periods of time there, and other things. So the examples abound. We've heard from many community members through this process.
Now, also one of the new restrictions is may not sleep on certain surfaces. What would those be at certain times?
Well, we don't allow people to lay down on the ground. We're not going to allow people to lay down on benches between 5 a.m. and 10 p.m. And that coincides with the heaviest use of the pedestrian mall and when our city crews are there trying to keep it clean, that kind of thing. We've also had issues with people leaving, you know, occupying two or three benches with personal effects. We're setting up a way for the police to enforce that, and if they need to remove somebody's personal effects, create a system to take those down to City Hall or to the police station, log what is there, and then return it to the owner of that property cost-free at a different time.
You mentioned the reason for it being now the uptick in problematic behavior cited in the downtown area. I wonder if part of it is also that there's less tolerance for this behavior in downtown Iowa City. Iowa City, for those who have visited, it's very clear, is becoming a center for high-rise condominiums, and those residents with $500,000 condominiums might not want people sleeping on a city bench outside their high-rise door.
Yeah, well, I've heard that perspective as well. I'm not sure I share it. I think Iowa City is an exceedingly tolerant community, and it's one of the things that makes us a special place. But that tolerance has limits. And I think people in Iowa City feel that way whether they own a nice condominium downtown or are of modest means and live elsewhere. The key here is that we have a heavily used, very public space and lots of different people going into this area. And balancing the various interests is always a challenge. And I think if you dig into the ordinance that Iowa City staff came up with and proposed to the council, it's very sensitive. It's very thoughtful. It resulted from input from downtown business owners, from organizations that provide homeless and other social services, and a number of stakeholders. And it's sensitive to the needs of those who use this public space, including the least among us, those who are down on their luck and in need of help.
But you reject the criticism of some community members have of saying that these new restrictions target the homeless.
Yeah, I do reject that because they apply to everybody, homeless or wealthy. And we're talking about behavior in a very public space. And the approach that has been suggested, I think, is a tolerant one. It's a sensitive one, et cetera. And what I would say is that the city of Iowa City has a long history of supporting the organizations in this community that do God's work, so to speak, in terms of providing shelter to the homeless, providing transitional housing and other support to those who are in need.
Mm-hmm.
The city has given millions of dollars over the years to these organizations and continues to work with them to this day. Every year, we give hundreds of thousands of dollars to organizations that are doing very important work in the community. And so these ordinances are not intended to address that. The ordinance is instead intended to address behavior in a public space. Homelessness and poverty and mental health and substance abuse, you know, these are all challenges that communities face. Iowa City is not alone. We continue to partner with those important organizations in our community who are working on these issues.
Iowa City Mayor Matt Hayek, thank you for joining us today.
You bet.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Homelessness in Iowa, our topic this hour. How many people are we talking about? Well, according to a 2011 report by the Iowa Council on Homelessness, 17,900 homeless individuals throughout the state of Iowa in that year, 2011. In just a moment, we'll be joined by an Iowan to hear his story, an Iowan who used to be homeless. We'd like to hear from you. Have you ever been without a home for an extended period? What put you on the streets? How did you manage to get a roof back over your head again? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining me now, Chrissy Canganelli in our Iowa City studio, Executive Director of Shelter House. Shelter House is a nonprofit organization in Johnson County that has provided housing and supportive services to the homeless of Southeast Iowa since 1983. Chrissy Canganelli, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben.
You just heard me talk to the mayor of Iowa City about this new ordinance. Iowa City in the process of expanding an ordinance, not only dealing with more restrictions on panhandling, but behavior in the downtown. He called it very sensitive, very thoughtful in design, meeting the needs of the community, but also meeting the needs of the neediest in the community. Is that the way you see it as well?
I see the ordinance as something that the city felt was necessary. I see it as neither good or bad, but ordinances are part of the toolkit that cities have to try to impact behavior and have a certain amount of influence in an environment. Mm-hmm. So I understand the need, and I felt that it was a reasoned and very measured response to a problem that they have really invested time and resources and energy in, and they're not seeing the evolution that they would like to.
Mm-hmm. In this problem that was described by the mayor downtown, the reason for this new ordinance, how much of that problem can be ascribed to homelessness, the problem of homelessness in Johnson County in Iowa?
In so much as several of the individuals in the area that are consistently in the Ped Mall are homeless. Not all of them are homeless. There's a few of them that are. As they relate to the general homeless population, they're far less than 1% of who we see in any given year. So for the issues that we're addressing and the numbers of people that we see and we work with each year, you know, we had over 630 people that resided at Shelter House last year alone and another 300 that came through for our drop-in center services. So for the small number of people that are impacting people's feeling of comfortability or access to the downtown Ped Mall, I mean, again, understand contextually that that's far less than 1% of who we're working with in any given year.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned the figure of nearly 18,000 homeless people in the state that from a 2011 survey. I imagine you have your finger on the pulse here. What are you seeing over the last 5 or 10 years? Fairly stable at that number?
As far as the numbers go, yes. There's been a certain amount of a trend line going a little down, but I think that that's more of a result of changes in operating procedures and policies and rules at individual programs. So the numbers are relatively level, but we've got some restrictions that are going in place in certain areas that have to do with residency that do, to some extent, limit the numbers that we're reporting.
Mm-hmm. It may sound like a dumb question, but some may wonder what qualifies as homeless. Do you have to literally be out on the streets, or are you perhaps homeless if you can't afford housing and are living with a friend or a relative?
That's a good question. So the school district does include living doubled up, which was that example that you just gave, as being homeless. For access to the shelter and coming into our program, we're not going to prescribe a certain definition of homelessness. So if you have been living doubled up and you are no longer able to live in that situation, coming into the shelter is just fine. We don't deny you access on that. But there are issues as far as being able to access certain federal programs and specifically get into those programs that being doubled up would not permit you access. But people coming to us, they're needing a place to say we don't ask them to verify their homelessness as they're coming through our doors, coming through and residing with them with us. Then qualifies you as homeless. Okay, does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Let's say, Chrissy, that I come to the door of Shelter House in Iowa City and want to be admitted. What do you want to know about me before you admit me?
We go through an intake process where we try to begin to get some general information, demographic information, begin to have you tell us a little bit more about what brings you to us. It's very difficult at that first meeting to really delve into issues that have to do with health or some of the more systemic causes, but try to just kind of get an initial profile of you and if you're bringing your family, the ages, is there school of age children in the family, because there are different connections that we need to get started right away. The more in-depth conversation with the individual is going to happen about 3 days, within 3 days of your stay, where we get into that deeper assessment and you're meeting with the case manager and delving into more of the systemic causes. But we just really want a basic impression and some demographic information, identifying information. And we'll also do, I have to mention this, a background check on you as far as the sex offender registry. That is the one limit that we have. We do not serve registered sex offenders, so we are going to get that at the point of intake. And sobriety, we'll ask you to do a breathalyzer, and we do breathalyzer tests every night.
Chrissy Kengadeli, Executive Director of the Shelter House, my guest, as we talk about homelessness in Iowa this hour. And joining us now also, David McGee. He works at the Shelter House in the area of operation support and maintenance there. David is in our Iowa City studio. Hi, David.
Good morning.
You were homeless, I understand, off and on since the 1980s until about 2008. And I really want to thank you very much for coming into the studio and being willing to talk about, from a first-person perspective, mm-hmm. how you became homeless. Tell us that story. How did it happen?
My thing, I believe, was alcoholism. I just couldn't. I could get a job long enough to get paid, and I just paid. It was a lot easier for me just to go live out in the woods and be away from people. And as far as it come to happen, it's like I said, it's alcoholism. It just engulfed me one day.
So, did you have a family?
I had a very good family.
Yeah, you had a family.
I had a good family.
Where were you at this point?
This goes all the way back to the 70s, you know, a kid.
Okay, but what part of the country were you in when you started to slip into this?
In North Carolina.
Okay. Go ahead and talk about that. So at what point did you consider yourself homeless? Did you leave your family at some point?
It got to the point where I didn't understand why everybody else could keep a job. Everybody else had money in their pocket. Everybody else had this and that. And I couldn't do it because I drank too much, you know. I just couldn't do like everybody else. And I didn't know why. And it was a question to me for a long time, can't do nothing about it, might as well get drunk, right? And, of course, it's something you ask yourself all the time. I remember just being in the middle of the field and just looking at the sky, go, why me, man, you know? Mm-hmm. And to cover up the pain, you drank some more and forget about it, you know? I come from a good family. It's just something that took over me and the damnedest thing I've ever seen in my life. You know?
So years you spent more or less homeless. Living in woods or
drifting around, finding some woods to live in. Plus, like you mentioned earlier, what does homelessness entail? I've lived in shelters, Salvation Army ARC in the 80s. That's considered homeless. Well, you go in there and you need help with your alcoholism. And I was homeless in that aspect also.
How did you find enough? If you go to a shelter, you have something to eat. Did you always have enough to eat or was that
Oh, yeah. I always had enough to eat.
How did you feed yourself?
When I was out in the woods.
Sure.
In Iowa City, I went to free lunch in the Sally at night. That's how I ate most of the time. Get some ramen noodles at night, and if you want to make them in your tent or whatnot. And
You'd come across other people in the community. How were you treated? Were you recognized immediately, often as homeless?
When you get on the bus and you smell like smoke and everything else, you get attention like that. Yeah, I think people actually, when I quit, stopped drinking, and I still looked the same, people asked me, how do you manage being homeless? And I looked homeless, even though I had moved in. They still asked me, what's it like to be homeless? I guess I just looked homeless. It's a stereotype or whatnot of somebody homeless, you know.
So you were homeless off and on since the 1980s, maybe going back to the 1970s, the sort of start of this. It doesn't seem to have an absolutely clear start until about 2008. What was the turning point for you?
I caught tuberculosis, and I went up there to the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics for 6 weeks. My turning point was I realized you got to quit straddling the fence. You either going to drink yourself to death or start living sober. You know, I just got through struggling with it, I guess. So when I left there, I went to work. This guy hired me to do some painting and stuff, and then I hooked up with the shelter. I went to check my mail one day, and they was looking for somebody to paint the building, and they asked me if I wanted to do it, and that's how I got started with the whole shelter house thing.
Uh-huh.
And it was right on time, because if you want to sober up, something to do was very important.
Well, you can say that. You can think that you need to sober up, but doing it is another thing. What gave you the strength to day after day, and I assume you're not drinking to this day?
No.
What gave you the strength day after day?
I had a whole lot of people in my life that helped me. You know, I stayed busy. I hooked up with Shelter House. I hooked up with Mary Pomberg, and we delivered furniture all over Johnson County for like 3 years. But I think the most important thing is the people in my life that were there with me, you know, telling me, man, you can do this, you know.
Your support.
My support, thank you very much. It was the support. Like some people might use AA. I don't do AA. There's too many people in there for me. But that's their key. My key was the support of people around me, you know. Sometimes I'd stay sober for them,
right.
You know, when I'm having a really bad day, you know, and it was that's been my support.
And this new life has been since approximately 2008. How do you describe your life now?
You know what? It's incredible. And sometimes I still go outside at night and look out at, you know, on my front porch and go, wow, this is really happening. You know, it's still new to me, this new life I got.
Even though it's been several years.
Yeah. I'm a grandfather now. I never would have got to do that. I've got a good relationship with my son. And it's been incredible for me. I say it's still overwhelming to me.
It sounds like it is. Mm-hmm. You come into contact with – well, we're coming up on a break. Let's come back to you in just a minute. David McGee is with us. He was homeless off and on since the 1980s until about 2008. He's telling us how he became homeless and what turned it around for him. He now works in operation support and maintenance at Shelter House in Iowa City. Also with us, Chrissy Canganelli is with us, executive director of Shelter House. It's a nonprofit organization, provided housing and supportive services to homeless people of Southeast Iowa since 1983. And their website is shelterhouseiowa.org. We'll also ask about a benefit that they have coming up this weekend, I believe. Ask Chrissy about that when we come back. Also, when we come back, Tony Tim will be with us, executive director of Central Iowa Shelter and Services. That's located in Des Moines. We'll ask him what trends he's been seeing. Have you been without a home for an extended period? What put you in that circumstance? And how did you manage to remove yourself from the ranks of the homeless? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with more of River to River in just a moment. This is Iowa Public Radio News. Thank you for joining this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about homelessness, an update on homelessness in Iowa this hour. Chrissy Canganelli is with us, executive director of Shelter House, providing not only housing but supportive services to the homeless people of Southeast Iowa going back to 1983. Also with us, David McGee. He works at the Shelter House in Iowa City. in operation support and maintenance. David was homeless off and on over the last several decades until about 2008 when he turned things around, and he's been sharing his story with us this hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, if perhaps you've been homeless for an extended period, 1-866-780-9100. We're talking about how that happens and how you improve your circumstances if that does happen to you or a loved one. 1-866-780-9100. River2River@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. Also joining us now in our Des Moines studio, Tony Tim is with us, Executive Director of Central Iowa Shelter and Services. That's located in Des Moines. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I'm looking at your website. Since 1992, you've been at work there, providing free shelter, meals, right? And when you see people, I asked this to Chrissy just a few moments ago, when you see people coming in the door, what do you want to know about them?
Well, you know, first we just want to get to know what we have to get to know about them to track a little demographic information and who they are and where they're coming from. And over the next few days, we'll really try to drill down in what has led them to us. Was it a lack of education? Was it substance abuse? Was it a mental health concern? And then how do we best find community partners to help us get them back to being self-sufficient?
You're the largest homeless shelter in the state of Iowa, I believe, over 200 beds?
Correct. We have 209 beds. We have everything from emergency housing to transitional to permanent, all in one new facility that we opened last September.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand, Chrissy, you turn away a good number of people every night. How many?
The past few weeks, it's been averaging anywhere from 10 to 20 people a night.
Mm-hmm. Where do they go then?
Well, there is nowhere else for them to go, unless they are fortunate enough to have family and friends who really, in a pinch, will be able to take them in. We're the only shelter, homeless shelter in the county, so there's nowhere but the street to turn.
Mm-hmm. Do you turn away people also in Des Moines, Tony?
We haven't had to yet. We are fortunate enough to have a large enough space with some extra programming space. We've got a couple TV lounges with chairs that we can allow people to stay in overnight until we can find a better place for them.
What trends have you seen in terms of the numbers of homeless in the Des Moines area, perhaps the type of people seeking support from you?
Well, I think, you know, prior to the collapse of 2008 in the economy, everybody, there's this old image that people seem to have in their head of folks that are homeless, of somebody being drunk down by the river. And I think with the collapse of the economy in 2008, it really opened a lot of people's eyes that were living paycheck to paycheck, and all of a sudden they knew could have been their friend or a niece or their daughter or their son. I mean, all of a sudden there was this real personal connection to folks that at any time could be homeless due to a loss of a job or a family tragedy. And I think it's just being more aware now that it's not, none of us are above it, right? It could happen to any of us any day.
Mm-hmm. So you see entire families come through your door in need?
Well, our service center will serve families either in our clothing closet, food pantry, or the healthcare clinic, but we don't shelter youth overnight. We focus on adult men and women, 18 and older, because we take everybody every night under any influence. So we have folks coming in under different substances, mental health concerns. So we would find a family shelter for them to go to if they had youth.
You were listening to our first half hour. I understand we also talked with the mayor of Iowa City, Matt Hayek, about some new restrictions that are in the process of getting approved for Iowa City, some further restrictions on panhandling in the downtown area, also on just other behavior, sleeping in certain areas in the downtown during certain hours. Do you think that's an appropriate response? Do you have similar problems in Des Moines that you have to be involved with?
You know, I think it's the realization that excuse me, that folks that are panhandling make other people uncomfortable. And, you know, as you can understand the business point of view that they don't want folks outside creating distractions from people coming in and using their business. But at the same time, I think we have to pause and just think about what if it were you, right? What if you had nowhere to go? You had no means to buy any food. I think we all would figure out a way to ask somebody for money or, I mean, you just become resourceful. You figure out what you need to do to survive today. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's at least positive to hear that Iowa City gave a lot of thought to it, that they're going to try to make it the same for everybody. And they're trying to work proactively on the problem.
Mm-hmm. Chrissy Canganelli, what are your thoughts on how many people who have their hands out or have a sign out who are asking for money are actually homeless?
From what I've seen and the people that I've known over the last 15 years in serving the homeless population in our community, I'd say it's probably a 50-50 split. I mean, I've known scenarios where there are people who live together, they have a car, and they literally have shifts and are driving around. It's like a small cottage industry. They're not homeless. They're very invested in this essentially small enterprise that they've started, and it's lucrative.
How do you tell the difference if you want to help someone out in need?
Well, you can't, and that's the thing. And helping someone out in need, even if the individual is homeless, 19 out of 20 times, please know that when you are giving someone money who's panhandling, you're feeding their addiction. So it may make you feel better for the next 5 minutes, and you may convince yourself that you've done something good, but you've added to a world of hurt.
So what is a reaction that you could say would be something you could stand behind? People either give them money. I think most often a reaction is, by far, is that for many people, when confronted with a panhandler suddenly and unexpectedly interrupting their routine, their walk through the downtown, it makes them terribly uncomfortable, and there's just a non-response. And ignoring the person, is that the right response?
That is actually the worst response, because it's the most dehumanizing thing that you could do. But I understand in the situations where the individual is getting quite aggressive, at some point you do want to be able to get away. So we're talking about the more passive panhandling. Please make eye contact. Treat the person like another human being with dignity. It is the worst possible thing to just walk by the person and pretend that you haven't seen them. That adds to that individual's sense of lack of dignity, lack of self, the whole issue that allows them to be on that sidewalk.
What is the response if you don't want to give, and you gave us a reason not to give? What is a response to give that doesn't take away dignity?
To say that you support the organizations in the community that are there to help them.
Okay. David McGee, McGee is with us. He was homeless and chose as part of this interview not to talk about panhandling, but we do want to talk about it here too with Tony. Tim, is that the alternative that you see that you recommend for people in the Des Moines area?
Yeah, we've actually gone another step further and created something we call our homeless help kit. And so it's a little backpack that has some basic toiletries and a pair of socks and information about our organization in. And we've given those out to security companies in the downtown area. We give them out to law enforcement, and we give them out to the general public. If they encounter somebody that's, you know, panhandling, they can just politely say, you know, I don't have any money, but I've got this kit, and it'll lead you to a place where you can get some clothes, you can get food, you can get shelter. It'll lead you somewhere where there's hope and folks that are willing to help you.
Tony, do you agree that in your experience that when we give to panhandlers, we're, as Chrissy said, feeding an addiction?
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality, unfortunately, is that when people are, they're not always going to make the right choices. And so if you're just giving it to them and they're hitting the first convenience store, we know that they're going to make the wrong choice.
Mm-hmm. Substance abuse was a part of your background, David McGee, and talking about the decades off and on that you were homeless. Now, thankfully, you're not. It took so long for you to turn your life around, to get out of that situation. Was that at some point, did you changed your mind? Or could there have been services earlier on that would have helped you earlier on?
Well, be honest with you, I was faced with a life and death situation, is what the man told me, the doctor. If you keep on drinking like you do, your immune system's going to be down. You'll probably catch tuberculosis again and die. I have seen a lot of friends drink themselves to death. And you hit the realization that it's life or death, man. This ain't no game no more. This is life or death. You either sober up or you die.
If you wouldn't have been faced with that life or death tuberculosis, you would have continued on perhaps to this very day?
Probably. I wouldn't be sitting here today, probably. But probably, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 1-866-780-9100 if you'd like to join our conversation as we discuss homelessness in Iowa. I wonder, Tony, Tim, if you have a success story to share from your personal experience there in the Des Moines area, someone who came to you and left having been helped by the services that you offer.
Sure. We have a lot of them each year. We had one of my first years working for the organization, we had two people that worked all summer at the at Principal Park at, for the Iowa Cubs, and they sold concessions all summer long and saved enough money that at the end of the season they were able to get an apartment, and we haven't seen them back. Mm-hmm. We have people that complete their GED that are staying with us and then are able to find employment and continue forward. So, you know, there's a lot of people each day that find a way out with the right help. And then there are a number of folks that our communities are going to have hard conversations on how we're going to provide better service for them long term. I mean, some of the folks that we serve with mental illness, the mental illness is so severe they've been lost in the system. And because they have no income, there's nowhere for them to go. Mm-hmm. But they don't deserve to be staying in a homeless shelter for the rest of life or incarcerated because they make a bad mistake.
Is that a problem that has existed throughout the decades or more recently with concerning mental health specifically?
You know, I think it probably goes back to, was it the 80s when a lot of the mental health or, facilities were in shutdown mode and people were passed back to their families and said good luck? And, you know, since then there just hasn't been enough money put into that system to provide the level of care that some of these folks need.
Chrissy Canganelli, talk a little bit more about outcomes that you look for when serving.
Yeah, we've really invested a lot of our resources in helping people move beyond homelessness. So we get invested in the vocational training, job placement, retention, housing searches, housing placement. And I can say out of the 630 people that resided at Shelter House last year, over 420 moved into their own housing. That's incredible to me. They're no longer homeless. Nearly that same number were employed when they exited. We have over 45% of the folks that we work with have serious health issues, systemic health issues, so they access Social Security, disability benefits as other sources of income. So between those benefits and employment, we're able to help individuals get into housing, retain housing, and live independently in our community. But the numbers of people, hundreds of people that are getting jobs, seeing themselves as part of the workforce and contributing to the community, those are the really positive, uplifting, amazing stories that really define what is homelessness in our state today.
Tony, Tim, I imagine the hardest case are those who don't seek out help or don't want help. What do you do with someone who needs the services but refuses to go along?
Well, when folks check in with us, they initially get a 90-day stay. And at that 90 days, if they address whatever issue led them to us, education, substance abuse, mental health concerns, they can get extensions and stay longer. If they have the ability to help themselves and they have no want to participate in that process, then after 90 days, they have to exit our facility and then be out for 90 days. So occasionally we get somebody that gets caught in this cycle of in 90 days, out 90 days, back in. You know, we just keep thinking, you know, I tell folks all the time, we are the home of the 18th, 19th, and 20th chance. If we give up, then we've failed. So we have to try every time somebody presents themselves and hope that this is the time that we're going to have that life-changing moment.
I'm wondering if your shelters, your respective shelters differ. Chrissy Canganelli, do you have someone who may be an alcoholic who continues to abuse alcohol? Do you allow them within your...
No, that is the defining difference between one of the defining differences between our programs is that we're not a wet facility. So we breathalyze every night. We will also, if there's a reason to suspect illegal drug use, we'll drop UAs. We're right across the street from Mecca. We work with people if during their stay they start drinking or using again. We work with them to get into Mecca, access services there, and they know that they can return to us after they've demonstrated that they'll work with Mecca to address their substance abuse.
And Tony, Tim, that's a difference with your facility. You, unlike some shelters, Shelter House, for example, you allow people who are abusing alcohol to stay in your facility. What's the thinking there?
Well, our organization actually formed back in the early 90s. In 1991, five people froze to death on the streets of Des Moines because they were denied shelter and they were intoxicated. And eight churches came together at that time and formed our organization. So since that day, the focus was we'll serve every adult every night under any influence. Part of that is, you know, by us doing that, we're also reducing healthcare costs for people being, you know, exposed to frostbite or hypothermia or being out and then having to go to the hospital to be treated for things, reducing jail visits for people that are found out being publicly intoxicated. So, you know, there's some cost savings in that manner as well.
Mm-hmm. You said a moment ago that we need to have a conversation about what we do with the people who don't want services. Why do we need to have that conversation, Tony?
Well, you know, I think it's I always try to tell folks that, you know, regardless of which way you vote, there's a cost to all of us as taxpayers to take care of communities. And you can either invest with organizations like Shelter House and Central Iowa Shelter and Services, and we can, you know, do what we can to work with people and get them back on the right path. Or unfortunately, you're going to have to build more prisons to incarcerate people that make the wrong choices. And that comes at a much higher tax cost to all of us than it is to invest with organizations like ours that can do great things for people.
David McGee, having been homeless for many years, when you total it all up, what do you think is the answer to this question? You would have been, I think, as you describe it, in that category as someone who didn't seek out help, didn't want help. What can we do with this category of people?
Leave them alone. If they want it, eventually they will come to you. Until then, leave them alone.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chrissy Canganelli, there's something. What is out there in the future as things that we can do to further help as many homeless as we can?
Sure. So continuing to support organizations, as Tony said, our two organizations, I think, are really good examples of good work happening in our state. Shelter House is really invested in helping people move beyond homelessness, helping them get into jobs, housing, access health services, working with those families and the kids to make sure that they're going to school. But there's a whole aspect of the homeless population that we're really not reaching out to. It's a small number, very concentrated number, but they are, although a small number, costing our communities a great deal of money. And these are the individuals that are considered service resistant, if you would want to use that terminology.
What we were just talking about, right?
Right. So there are examples of models that have been implemented across this country in several metropolitan areas that provide housing first as an option for individuals that are service resistant, chronically homeless. They're cycling through our systems time and time again with no change in their well-being or in their general condition, and at great cost to our communities. So, for example, somebody who's coming through the shelter, they leave the shelter, they start drinking again, they go back into treatment, they're out of treatment, they are back on the street, they get picked up by the police, they end up into corrections and jail, they're in the emergency rooms, the psych ward. All of these things come at great cost to our community and at great cost to humanity. So there are these two different levels of cost that we could start really talking about. And again, to no improvement in the general condition of the individual. And the individual, in fact, is just continuing to deteriorate. Why not look at changing how we spend this money, our time, and our resources, invest it differently, work together through through coalitions, and leverage our resources to provide housing first, which means that we would make available a certain number of apartments, invite certain targeted individuals in to their own home. They don't have to sober up first. They don't have to address their mental health first. You provide those wraparound services on site, make them available. And over time, these communities have seen that people do stop drinking so much. They're not going to be interfacing with law and corrections so much because they have a door and a roof over their head. Mm-hmm. So it changes the equation entirely.
David McGee, we've just got a couple minutes left, but you work at Shelter House now. I wonder, do you often, I can only imagine you come into contact with the people that Shelter House serves. Do you often share your story with the people who come to Shelter House with more or less the message, I've been there, I've walked in your shoes?
Actually, it was cool the other day. I was sitting in front of Hy-Vee grocery store. A kid come sat beside me. He started talking about getting his kid back. And come to find out, he'd seen me at the shelter. I guess I'd seen him. And it was cool that I got to sit there and say, you'll get your kid back, man, you know. They understand what you're going through, and you'll get your kid back. They're smarter than they thought. And that one-on-one thing, that was a good deal. I never met them before, and we had that conversation.
You shared some of your story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going through the same thing you're going through, and it'll be all right, man.
What could you say past that, then it will be all right? Did you give him some sort of the beginning of a path toward some sort of normalcy in life, getting his kid back?
I just told him, you're going to have days when you feel like throwing your hands up and say, forget it, man, but just hang in there, you know. Mm-hmm. Just get through that day and stay focused on what you're doing here.
Very quickly, Tony, Tim, can you tell us what's the one thing that can be done in Iowa that isn't being done right now or not to the extent that you see is necessary to deal with homelessness?
We've got a great new facility thanks to our community and our donors, but what we really need to focus on now is the creation of truly affordable permanent housing, units that individuals and families can afford, 30% of area median income, and, you know, with a checkered past. And right now that just doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that, Chrissy?
It is becoming much more prohibitive to access housing. So, yeah, increasing the stock of affordable housing, permanent housing, having more diversity in your housing stock and your options. Programs like Housing First, transitional housing, permanent supportive housing, our lodge that we started, which is essentially a cooperative living, cooperative work model.
Okay. Tell us how people can get and find out more about Shelter House. I want to ask the same of you, Tony, Tim, in just a moment. How can people find out more?
ShelterHouseIowa.org.
And you have a benefit coming up this weekend.
And we do. We have a benefit Saturday at the Engler. Please join us, 6:30.
Okay. Tony, Tim, how do people find out more about the Central Iowa Shelter and Services?
You can find us at CentralIowaShelter.org.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tony, Tim, and Chrissy Canganelli. Also, big thanks to David McGee for stepping forward with your personal firsthand experience. We appreciate it, sir.
You're welcome.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. Executive producer of our talk shows, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.